from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Western democracies have long been fascinated by ancient Rome as a model and as a cautionary tale, a republic of free citizens that grows and grows in power and in learning, but that ultimately embraces a dynasty of dictators, the Caesars. The reigns of Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero were grand spectacles of murder, treachery, debauchery. They captivated Romans then, and they captivate us to this day. Why? This hour on Point, a new look at the first dynasty of dictators who ruled Rome. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you remember the tale of Nero setting fire to Rome and singing as it burned Caligula's murderous lust? Why do we always fear our democracies will go the way of Rome? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is historian Tom Holland, author of Persian Fire, The Forge of Christendom, and Rubicon, which tells the story of the end of the Roman Republic. His new book picks up from where Rubicon left off. It's called Dynasty, The Rise and Fall of the House of Caesar. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Tom Holland, it's great to have you. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks very much for asking me on.
So you quote Tacitus right off the bat here, saying the histories of Tiberius and Caligula, Claudius and Nero were falsified while they remained alive out of dread, and then after their deaths were composed under the influence of still festering hatreds. If everything that comes down to us from that time is tainted with either dread or hatred, how does a historian know where the facts lie?
It's a very challenging problem. And I think the answer to it really is to look at each of these extraordinary figures and the stories that are told about them in the broader context, both of the dynasty that they belong to and of the much broader history of Rome. Now, you're absolutely right that the stories that are told about these emperors are so shocking that someone like Caligula, even today, is probably as familiar to pornographers as he is to classicists. What are we to make of a figure like that as a political operator? Was he the depraved lunatic monster of imagination, or might we perhaps, if we place him in the context of the age, get some sense of what he was actually about? And the premise of my book is that if we look at them in context, we do indeed see that much of what they did was sufficiently shocking to explain why they have these terrible reputations. We also, I think, see that this is the primal example of how a tyranny emerges that has haunted the imagination of the West ever since. But what I think we also see is that there are lessons here that abide to this day, and that in some ways, monstrous though they were, these first Caesars were political operators of a kind that we can just about recognise today as well. So I think it's the fusion of all those elements that make this such a compulsively fascinating story.
Do us a favour, Tom Holland, back up to Rubicon, and we could spend days doing this, but give us the short course on bridging from the Roman Republic, when citizen meant something, when there was a kind of representation of that citizen public, when power was not concentrated in the hands of a single Caesar. Take us through what were the dynamics, and just a bit on the people who took us from that era of Roman history into the time of these Caesars, these dictators.
Well, we might want to go right the way back to the beginnings of the Roman Republic, which was founded, much as, say, the American Republic was, as a result of a rebellion against a king. And king became a dirty word in the Roman political vocabulary, and the political system that was set up by the Romans was designed to ensure that no one person would ever attain a position of dominating power. And that worked well for several centuries, and the energies of Rome's great men, and they were always men because women did not have political rights, were directed outwards against the unfortunate neighbours of the Romans and enabled Rome to rise to a superpower status. Now, the first century BC, what happens is that the great men of Rome, people like Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar, most notoriously, are able to obtain such power for themselves, such wealth, and such a transcendent reputation that they end up putting the entire republic in their shadow. And they end up in a position where, essentially, if it comes between upholding the dignity of the republic or the dignity of a man like Julius Caesar, Caesar decides that he is going to stick up for himself. He launches a civil war, in effect, to defend himself from the machinations of his enemies. And in this civil war, such is the gold and the manpower that he has won in his role as governor of Gaul, what's now France, that he is able to defeat his enemies, including Pompey, his only real heavyweight rival, to put the entire republican system absolutely under his thumb. But the problem that Caesar then faces is, how does he institutionalize his power? Because the Romans remain a republican people. They remain hostile to the notion that one man should have an absolutely autocratic control over them. So what Julius Caesar does is he does what the Romans always do when they're faced with a revolutionary system, which is to look back to the past to try and find something that will enable them to veil what has been what has become revolutionary. And Caesar goes back and he finds that although political roles within the republic generally are circumscribed, you only hold them for a year and you have to be elected to them, there is one role, that of dictator, which is given to a citizen in moments of particular crisis, and he is given absolute authority, but for a period of 6 months. So that is the position that Julius Caesar takes on to disguise his power. But what he then does is, because he doesn't want to be limited to 6 months, he declares that he is dictator essentially for life. And that is recognized by his peers as essentially being a land grab, that he is becoming a dictator in the modern sense of the word. And so they decide to kill him. And they kill him in the hope that by doing so, the Republic will be restored. But Caesar's murder on the Ides of March doesn't actually solve anything. It just precipitates the Republic into what turns out to be its final and terminal crisis.
Take us then from that into what you call the House of Caesar. These who followed, dictators that followed, huge names. We come to Caesar Augustus. Of course, many will know this name from in the New Testament, time of Caesar Augustus, yep. Birth of Jesus. What's the transition from that murder, the Ides of March, the murder of Julius Caesar, to Caesar Augustus, his role, and how it flows on into the others?
Well, Caesar Augustus is born Octavius, and he is the great nephew of Julius Caesar. And Caesar, before he is assassinated, adopts Octavius. And he's often called by historians Octavian. The Roman word Octavianus means someone who was called Octavius, who has been adopted. But that's not what the one time Octavius called himself. He calls himself Caesar because that is now his name. And he inherits the charisma of Caesar's name, and he inherits his cash. And before he is 20 years old, so while he's still in his teens, he has raised a private army, he has made himself consul at the point of a sword, and he has teamed up with Julius Caesar's great lieutenant, a man called Mark Antony, to essentially wipe out the political elite of Rome and to appropriate their cash, which he then spends on raising even more armies. Antony and the man that historians tend to call Octavian, but I think we should call the young Caesar, to emphasize the degree to which his standing derives from his rank as the son of Caesar. Mm-hmm. So the young Caesar and Antony go and wipe out the armies of the assassins of Caesar. They are then essentially in control of the entire Roman world. It's divided in two. Mark Antony gets the eastern, more prosperous half, and he famously shacks up with the Queen of Egypt, Cleopatra. The young Caesar gets the western half, but crucially, that includes Rome. And he then uses his wealth and his standing to win over the Roman people to his cause. And by Caesar's assassination, 44 BC, by 31 BC, the young Caesar is ready to go to war with his erstwhile ally, Antony. They meet in a great sea battle at Actium. Antony is defeated. The following year, Antony and Cleopatra commit suicide. The young Caesar is now effectively master of the entire Roman world. He takes over Cleopatra's kingdom as his own private fiefdom. Egypt is sensationally rich. And the young Caesar is now, he has about 40 legions. He has all the wealth of Egypt behind him. There is no one in a position to stand up to him. But he is very clever. He has been incredibly brutal in his determination to get to the top. He has killed where he's had to kill. He's murdered. He's slaughtered his way to the top. But now, having got to the top, he recognises that the key is to reassure his fellow citizens that he's not going to continue in the role of a murderer and that he's not going to make himself dictator in the way that his adoptive father had done. And so he announces with a great flourish that he is laying down his powers, that he is banishing the legions to the frontiers of the empire, that he wishes to be known simply as princeps, which means first citizen. That's all he's interested in. And the Senate are so relieved that they offer him essentially a huge province which contains all the legions that are on the frontier. So he retains control of the army. And they give him this extraordinary title, Augustus. And we are maybe dimmed to what this means. You know, people are called Augustus to this day. Mm-hmm. But what it essentially means is someone who is midway between heaven and earth. And so the key for this man who has become Augustus is that he's simultaneously a regular guy. You know, he's just a citizen
first
like
among
any
equals.
Other citizen.
Mm-hmm.
First among equals. On the other hand, he has this extraordinary name. And interestingly, he spends his whole life collecting extraordinary names. So he also calls himself Imperator, which means a victorious general. And it's where the English word emperor comes from. That's his proper name.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the dictators who ruled Rome after the fall of the Roman Republic. The first, all from one dynasty, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero. What a crew. Looking at why they rose, how they ruled, Tom Holland tells the story in his new history, Dynasty, The Rise and Fall of the House of Caesar. You can join us as well. What's your question on these emperors? Augustus, Caligula, Nero, more? Do you see how they used fear and spectacle, as Tom Holland describes it, to rule? Could the Romans have scrambled back somehow to the old ways of the citizens' republic? Of course, all this history has gripped imaginations ever since. Here's a scene from the 1979 movie Caligula, the Emperor Tiberius, a successor to Caesar Augustus, Tom Holland just describing. Here, played by Peter O'Toole, wanders through one of his grotesque orgies with his young grandnephew Caligula, played by Malcolm McDowell, and tells him how to rule.
Serve the state, Caligula, although the people in it are wicked beasts.
But they love you, Lord.
Oh, no. They fear me. And that is much better.
Fear me, and that is much better. Here, right on through the 1951 movie Quo Vadis, Peter Ustinov playing Emperor Nero as Rome burns.
Take now this rod, oh, receive an army play. Consume her as would a furnace. Burn on, O ancient Rome! Burn on!
Oh boy, and so comes the legend. Tom Holland tells the history, Dynasty, the Rise and Fall of the House of Caesar, joins us from London. It's quite a read. Tom Holland, explain the House of Caesar and how these four or five dictators you describe hang together.
Well, Augustus establishes himself as simultaneously the man of the people and an almost divine figure. And he rules for a very long time. He gets given this extraordinary name Augustus in 27 BC and he dies in AD 14. And that really gives it time for the regime to bed down. And in that time, Augustus gives the Roman people and indeed the world the great gift of peace. They've been ravaged by civil wars. Augustus gives them peace. That's what they want more than anything else. He also beautifies Rome. He finds it a city of brick, famously, and leaves it a city of marble. And he entertains them with gladiatorial displays and chariot races. So he establishes himself as a not just a popular figure, but an almost semi-divine figure. And when he dies, such is his charisma that anyone who can claim to be his heir automatically has the kind of rank that will enable him to rule. And so the House of Caesar is essentially that group of aristocratic figures who can lay claim to his family line. Now, that's not just the bloodline, it's also by the line of adoption. Adoption was very commonly practiced in Rome. And Tiberius, who we heard there played by Peter O'Toole, he was adopted by Augustus because he was the son of Augustus's wife, Livia, his stepson. And you know, we've been listening to how often these extraordinary figures appear in popular films and things, but also in popular drama. People who've watched The Sopranos, it's not a coincidence that Tony Soprano's mother is also called Livia. And it actually opens with Tony Soprano has a long discussion on the bleachers about what, how and why it was that Augustus succeeded. And this idea of him, I think, as a kind of mafia boss actually makes a lot of sense.
So the Julio-Claudian dynasty, it's called, and yeah. Explain the family connection there and how it gets this moniker.
Well, it's essentially two aristocratic families. You might sort of you imagine if the Bushes and the Clintons intermarried and you had the Bush-Clinton dynasty. That's kind of what it is. The Julians obviously are descended from Julius Caesar. The Claudians are the grandest and snootiest aristocratic dynasty in Rome. Livia, Augustus's wife, is herself a Claudian. Her first husband was a Claudian. So Tiberius, he's not only the adopted son of Augustus and therefore in that sense a Julian, he's also the blood descendant of the Claudians. So he really couldn't be posher. On top of that, he's also Rome's most brilliant general. So he brings that to the party as well. However, he subscribes to a very kind of highbrow, anti-populist style of rule. And that means that he's not tremendously popular with the masses. He affects to, well, actually, he doesn't affect to, he does scorn them. But equally, on becoming emperor, although he wants the Senate to feel that he's on their side, that he's one of them, that he is a great aristocrat as they are, it's very awkward because, of course, he's also absolutely has the supreme control
taking all
of life
the power
and death over them. Yes.
They're so all afraid and cowering.
I think ultimately the strain of that is such that Tiberius decides that he can't bear being in Rome. And so he retreats to the island of Capri off the Bay of Naples. And various stories are told about what he gets up to there. Now, out in the provinces, Tiberius is regarded with much admiration and devotion. He's the emperor when Jesus is crucified. And there were Christians who looked back and said that this was not a coincidence, that Tiberius had provided this age of peace and that that was why this extraordinary event had taken place under his watch.
You're right.
And he was hailed for his knowledge. But
they say the disciples could travel all over and spread the word because yes. of the same Roman rule that was instrumental in the crucifixion.
And it's not just Christians who are saying that. It's also whenever anything remarkable happens, so somebody finds a merman out on the Atlantic coast of Portugal and they immediately bring it to Tiberius because it's assumed that he is the person with the most knowledge of these kind of extraordinary things. So he's regarded as a man of great learning, a man of great wisdom. However, to the Romans in the capital, there is a deep-seated presumption that any political leader who wants a private life can only want that for one reason, and that is that he's a massive sexual pervert. And so they tell horrific stories about what he gets up to on Capri. And unfortunately for Tiberius's posthumous reputation, that is
that mud
has comprehensively stuck. But I think that it would make better sense to think of Tiberius as a kind of a Jeb Bush or Obama figure. That's the kind of, you know, in American terms, that's the political tradition he embodied.
I'm struggling to put that together with these super lurid descriptions from Capri. Yes. Oh, my gosh.
But then you think about, think about the stories that told about Obama by his political opponents. And this, of course, is an age where people can check up on them. And then you think about the sort of the untrammeled ability that the Romans in particular had. They absolutely adored gossip. I mean, they would have loved the internet and social media, I'm sure.
With all the stories told of President Obama, he's understood to be a family man. And what's described on the Isle of Capri and Tiberius is about as pervy as you can get.
Yes, and I think that reflects the fact that Tiberius was very, he was not a family man. I mean, that is not a phrase you would use to describe him to the degree that he essentially wiped out anyone who within his family whom he felt might be a threat to him. And the one person who survives is a young lad known by the nickname of Little Boots, or in Latin, Caligula, who eventually succeeds him. And Caligula is turns out to be a very different kind of leader, a very terrifyingly different kind of leader.
We'll come to it. We'll come to it. Lots of listeners for you, Tom Holland. The new book is Dynasty, The Rise and Fall of the House of Caesar. Peter, in Boston, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Peter.
Yes, thanks, Tom. Yeah, I'd like to be the advocate. I think there's sort of some positive feedback for the Julian emperors. First, let's at least acknowledge Augustus, who ruled about 40 or so plus years, setting ground, you know, the groundwork of the following emperors in the Roman Empire, which eventually the Pax Romana came in for in about 300 years. You know, Europe and Rome lived, you know, they had the greatest lifestyle and including England for hundreds of years in civilization. And we all know what happened in the Dark Ages. Second, with Tiberius, with Tacitus and people, Tiberius was a very successful general. He was an adopted by Augustus, and after one of the when Varus was defeated, Tiberius did very well as a general. He reluctantly when he became over.
And yep.
The free situation, I totally understand. I you know, there's remarks up there, etc. But I think as an effective Roman emperor, he was very good. Obviously, the exceptions are Nero and Caligula. They lived the style of absolute corruption. Coups absolutely with these people. They were
Peter. Let us hold that thought. We'll come to Nero, Caligula. But this the notion that. And you write in a manner that supports this, Tom Holland. They may have been perverted. They may have destroyed the Republic, but they built a great empire. And our caller says, look, whatever you thought of the Roman Empire, it beats the Dark Ages. How do you respond to that?
I yield to no one in my respect for Augustus as a political operator. I think he's the greatest political genius in the whole of Western history. He's absolutely right that his... No matter how unpleasant an individual he may have been in private, his achievements in redeeming Rome and indeed the world that it ruled from civil war is astonishing. And had he not done that, then it's perfectly possible that the entire empire would have imploded. I also absolutely agree about the ability of Tiberius, and I hope that I've emphasized his qualities. And you're absolutely right that the great military catastrophe of Augustus's reign, and one of the decisive moments in European history, is when three of his legions get wiped out beyond the Rhine at a time where Augustus had thought that Germany had been pacified and was ready to become a province. Three legions get wiped out, and it's perfectly possible that the Rhine frontier might have given, that the Germans might have crossed into Gaul and then, who knows, beyond the Alps into Italy. And it's Tiberius who... mans the defences, who resurrects the frontier fortifications and ensures that that doesn't happen. Now, it's an incredibly unglamorous job and it's not recognised by people back in Rome, but it's that is basically Tiberius's problem, is that he grinds away, he does what has to be done, but he doesn't do it in a glamorous way, and so nobody really notices. And that is always the problem for him.
And meanwhile, the true republic is receding in the rearview mirror as he pushes ahead. Henry in Augusta, Georgia. Henry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. There's
Hi.
A biography and also an historical analysis of Caligula. It's either out of Oxford or Cambridge. I read it about a year ago, so I don't remember the author's name. But Caligula was a very young man, and he was murdered by an internal palace coup. And the people really liked him, and he... straightened out a lot of the economic problems that Tiberius had created, because Tiberius was very penurious and had created an enormous depression and deflation. And people really liked Caligula, and when he died, the people really mourned him and missed him quite a bit, because their basic lot, whatever you call it, the average citizen, had much improved under him.
Henry, let us try and square that with Caligula's reputation. I mean, Tom Holland, you write, you remind us, the philosopher Seneca wrote of Caligula, nature produced him, in my opinion, to demonstrate just how far unlimited vice can go when combined with unlimited power. You have Seneca, you know, cringing and groveling before Caligula while he was alive. You say, Tom, that whatever merits Caligula may have had administratively, the age was a rotten one, diseased, debased, degraded. Caligula.
Well, I'm in describing that, I'm looking at it through Seneca's eyes, and Caligula was very rude about Seneca. So that's one of the reasons I think that Seneca is then so rude about him. I absolutely agree that Caligula was very popular with the people, and that was absolutely the whole point of his style of ruling. Both Augustus and Tiberius had looked back to the stern example of Roman tradition. They had respected and admired the political elite. They, in a way, identified themselves with the Republic, that the Republic, in a sense, had become absorbed into their person. Now, Caligula has...
That's a kind of perversion, if we can just pause with that, because
yes,
they may have looked back to it, but they destroyed it. They ignored it. They trampled it.
They destroyed it, but they felt that it was worth identifying themselves with.
But it was almost a ruse, a cover for their dictatorship. They talked the language of the Republic, and they acted as what they were, military dictators.
Absolutely. And they certainly did not countenance the possibility of restoring the Republic. But that said, they did, I think, authentically identify with the values and the traditions of the Republic. It's just that they wanted to identify themselves with that.
I just point out the distinction, because even today, this is a place where, you know, those who might take great power never stop talking about old values and traditions, but the clear-eyed Republicans...
There is nothing new under the sun. There is nothing new under the sun. Absolutely.
And Caligula, not as bad as the reputation? What do you say?
Well, Caligula has no respect for the Republic at all. He has no respect for tradition. What Caligula is doing is deliberately aiming over the heads of the elite to the masses and offering them what they want. And again, if we have, you know, we think of contemporary politics, we can think of all kinds of politicians in America and around the world who consciously reject the standards and the conventions of conventional political discussion and say outrageous things. And they find that by saying outrageous things, they actually become more and more popular. That is essentially what Caligula is doing. And he leads the life of a glamorous, a kind of star. That's what he's about. He's kind
spectacle.
Of like a film star.
Mm-hmm.
He is the first person to drive a 6-horse chariot. So he's sort of prancing around the streets of Rome and doing the kind of thing that the people want to see their emperor do. And he then moves on and he consciously dramatizes narratives and spectacles of humiliation, which are designed to make the traditional elite look as ridiculous as possible. And this, of course, delights the masses who are locked in a kind of class conflict with them. So if we think of the most famous story that's told about Caligula, the story that he wanted to make his horse a consul, the highest office in the state, and this is told as though to demonstrate that he's mad. I don't think that's the case at all. I think originally it was told as a joke, because the consulship was it's the focus of every ambitious Roman's dreams. It's kind of like winning the presidency. It's what you want more than anything else. What Caligula is doing is saying, actually, it's all in my power. And if I wanted to, I could make my horse a consul. And it's designed to put the Senate in its place.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom with a quick heads up for you. Be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love. It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the dictators who ruled Rome after the fall of the Roman Republic. From one dynasty right there, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero. What a crew. Tom Holland is with us, historian, author of Dynasty, The Rise and Fall of the House of Caesar. You can join us as well. Are you feeling echoes of all this in our American politics right now? Are we immune to the allure of the Caesar? Yes, all kinds of perversion and of certainly perverse treatment of what had been a republic. There's a scene in the 1979 Monty Python movie, Life of Brian. Members of an underground movement called the People's Front of Judea, they've got a plot, a terrorist attack on Pontius Pilate. Leader of the group, played by John Cleese, justifies the attack by asking, "What have the Romans ever given us?" His co-conspirators, in Monty Python style, humorously respond to that question. Well, they've done stuff, yeah.
The aqueduct?
Oh, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
And the roads. Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation. Medicine. Huh? Education.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Okay, a list of accomplishments, but what we fear is the tyranny. We fear the dynasties. Interesting how that runs. Just a couple of years ago, C-SPAN interviewed former First Lady Barbara Bush. There was talk then that her son Jeb might follow in her father's and brother's footsteps, run for the presidency. The interviewer asked whether she thought that was a good idea, and she said, "Enough of the political dynasties."
I think this is a great, great country. And if we can't find more than two or three families to run for high office, that's silly. I think that the Kennedys, Clintons, Bushes, they're just more families than that.
And we still howl about leaders who are feared that they'll go beyond the rules of the republic, deal as dictators, or just trade in spectacle. Here's President Obama a couple of weeks ago, East Room, announcing new measures on gun reform. This got a lot of kickback.
We also can't wait. Until we have a Congress that's in line with the majority of Americans, there are actions within my legal authority that we can take to help reduce gun violence and save more lives.
Tyranny, his opponents howled right away. On the other hand, you can hear Donald Trump drawing all kinds of complaints as well. Here he was at a Pensacola, Florida rally last week, working up the crowd. Tom Holland talks about the Roman Caesars doing some of that. Here is Trump excoriates the media, dishonest, bad people, congratulated himself, sneered at other candidates, threw a crowd pleaser of a line at in Jeb Bush's direction, and the crowd loved it.
It's not just me, it's you. It's a movement that's going on. We have a movement going on. This isn't like a normal situation. These other guys come up, the other candidates. Jeb Bush spent $69 million. He's nowhere. He's got nothing. We should give that money to the veterans and to the wounded warriors. That's where it should go.
Hooray! And so we fear and look back and think about all that has been. Lisa in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air with Tom Holland in London, Lisa.
Hello, Tom.
Hi there.
It sounds like a very fascinating book, and I've been interested in, especially in parallels between our American Empire and the Roman Empire, which in many ways I think are totally different. But
thank God.
I've seen some videos. There was a movie called Obsession that very clearly shows some videos from the Middle East that were created that make George Bush look like Satan. They're really horrible depictions. And one of my questions was, I wondered how accurate our impressions are of those historical figures. Is there some room for error in there? For example, do we really believe that Nero was fiddling while Rome burned? Or is that a story that's been created by people who dislike Nero or brought down through history in a wrong manner? And also, you know, I do think you've already pointed out there are a lot of parallels with America, and I'm just hoping you expound on that some more in your book.
We'll do it in this conversation, Lisa. Tom, dive in on either side of that.
Well, you ask about Nero. The thing about Nero is that, a bit like Caligula, he realized that you could make a splash and you could win win popularity by giving the people what they wanted. And in Nero's case, it was about giving them spectacle. So the story about him fiddling while Rome burned, I don't think that's true. But it does reflect the fact that Nero did play the lyre. And again, the lyre gives the wrong impression. This was not something that an emperor was meant to do. I think it's better
the
if you
lyre,
think about
like
him
a, playing, like a harp, sort of.
Because it makes him sound like an angel. Think about it. I think it's closer to the electric guitar. Basically, okay. What Nero was doing was headlining at a rock festival. That's kind of what he's up to. And you think about a politician doing that now, that would be regarded as very infra-dig.
Wait, but Rome was burning. Are you saying you believe that he was up there, you know?
No, I don't think he was. And I very much doubt that he set fire to Rome. And the reason that people thought that was because he then used the incineration of Rome to build an enormous pleasure palace. But it's possible that in building this pleasure palace, he was also building it for the people to go and visit. He was building huge sort of parks and things, so that kind of like a central park, I guess. And this was then misinterpreted by his enemies, of which there were many. But I think the thing about Nero is that all the reports that we get about him come from his enemies. But when he dies, it's clear that he was very, very popular. People continued to lay flowers on his grave, and fake Neros appeared. And we're told that the thing that qualified them to pretend to be Nero was the fact that they could play musical instruments very well. So we heard the Peter Ustinov singing terribly. Mm. Nero must actually have been pretty good, because even if you're the ruler of the world, you can't go and headline on a public stage in front of an enormous audience if you're absolutely hopeless. So I think that then becomes part of his mystique, that he is he's like a figure from Greek mythology who has come down onto the earth. And those are the roles that he's trying to play. I mean, he kills his mother. And you'd think that would be the kind of thing that any politician would not want to go on about.
No, I think not.
If you kill your mother, that's not going to go down well with the voters. Nero draws attention to it. He goes to Greece. He takes on the role of a mythical figure who killed his mother. So it's like he's drawing attention to it. And I think what he's doing there is basically saying to the world, look, I am a figure from the distant past. I am like a god. I am like a hero. These things happen to me. Is this not entertainment? And lots of Romans, lots and lots of Greeks, people across the empire did indeed think that it was entertainment. You know, his reputation is terrible among Christians because it is said that he was the first to persecute them. But among the Jews, it was very, very high. There's an extraordinary passage in the Talmud that says that Nero is the ancestor of one of the most prestigious rabbis to be cited in the Talmud. So you get they're up beneath the sort of surface gloss of his terrible reputation. You get the hints of an incredibly clever, charismatic figure.
Speak to Lisa's broader question there. You're the historian. You don't really take this on directly in the book, but help us here. You have written that this was a time of a military and financial superpower dominated by dynasts, populists, and ambitious plutocrats, and you've right there made the parallel with the U.S. It could have been the U.K. before, but take the U.S. today. Just for a minute, look at like and unlike, the era you're describing and the United States you look out on.
Well, I think the unlikes are absolutely obvious. I really don't think that there's any prospect of the United States going through a civil war so calamitous that people in America would be willing to surrender their democratic freedoms in exchange for stability and order.
Let us hope not.
I think I really don't see that on the horizon.
Good.
The likes, I suppose, are well, it's clearly the infant republic did look to Rome as a model. That's why you have a capital, and it's why you have a Senate in Washington.
And even the architecture.
America is the greatest power on the face of the earth at the moment, as Rome was back in the time of the Julio-Claudians. And as a result, you get what you see in America, multinational, multi-ethnic, multi-faith states emerging. That's what you get in Rome as well. I mean, that's what Christians, for instance, are doing in Nero's Rome. There is an anxiety that people like Christians, foreigners coming in with strange ideologies, strange views. Jews also are included. And, interestingly, in light of what Donald Trump has been saying about his policy on not allowing Muslims in, it was a regular policy of the emperors to ban Jews, to ban Christians. So Claudius issued a ban against Jews. So I think that there are parallels there, but it is also absolutely central to emphasize that often things that might seem familiar are not at all, and that the world of Rome is unfathomably different to ours. I think above all in terms of its ethics, because our ethics are so shaped by particularly a sense of Christian morality that it's very hard to think back into the kind of world that existed before that, in which cruelty was kind of, there was a kind of innocence about the cruelty of the Roman state. We do not have anything analogous to gladiatorial combats. We no longer have slavery. And to look back at Rome, the thing that makes the Caesars so terrifying, in a sense, is just a projection of what is terrifying about the whole of Roman society.
Could Rome have scrambled back somehow to its republican roots, its real republican politics? What put that out of reach, well, or was it?
No, I don't think it could. And I think the reason for that was that the republican system was okay for running a city-state, but it was not suited to the running of a huge global empire. Now, having said that, it is important to recognize that, in a sense, all of the Caesars were dependent on public support. So although we may describe them as dictators, we may think of them as autocrats, people with powers of life and death, there were limits on their power. One limit, of course, was that of assassination. Caligula and Nero both end up toppled in coups. Caligula is murdered. Nero faces rebellions in the provinces and orders himself to be killed. There is also a sense in which, far more than any comparable autocrat from other ancient empires that I can think of, a Roman emperor had to expose himself to the blast of the breath of the Roman people. So when they lay on gladiatorial combats, when Nero is headlining with his music or acting, he is subjecting himself to the test of popularity. If even an emperor could be booed. And so, in a sense, if people who've seen Gladiator will remember that's basically what the plot revolves around. And it's not inaccurate. A Caesar did have to carry the people with him. And when he lost the backing of the people, then he was often in trouble.
Michiko Kakutani writes in the New York Times review of your book that these wars of succession and vying for influence so vicious, she writes, as to make Game of Thrones or the Hunger Games seem almost polite in ancient Rome. Miguel in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Miguel, you're on the air with Tom Holland.
Yes. I think you all have dealt with the substantial bit of my question, the substance. So I'm wondering if you want to play a little party game.
Okay.
And if there were someone were putting on a movie about Rome today, and you and the author are the in charge of casting, who in our contemporary time that's in the news would you cast in the various roles?
Are we talking actors?
That's devilish, Miguel. Are you talking Hollywood actors or are you talking politicians?
Anybody that's in the news.
you're a rascal, Miguel. You're a rascal.
In the news.
I don't know.
Well, I think that probably the most Julio-Claudian political leader at the moment would be Putin. There's a real streak of Augustus about him, in that he comes to power supposedly by election. Russia nominally remains a democracy, just as Rome under the Caesars nominally remained a republic. And you also definitely get that kind of Nero aspect of him that he plays up to the gallery. Nero went to Greece to take part in the Olympics. The Olympics were postponed for a year so that Nero could take part.
Oh, wow.
He entered the chariot race. I mentioned that Caligula drove around with a 6-horse chariot. Nero entered the Olympics with a 12-horse chariot, absolutely impossible for him to control. He enters the race. He gets thrown from the chariot. They bring him out another one, and Nero goes on to win. And people often laugh at this and say, imagine that it must have been a ridiculous spectacle. But think about it. Nero gets thrown from his chariot. You've got the wheels slicing past. You've got the crash of horse hooves all around
him.
To get back into a chariot and to finish that race, I mean, that takes some nerve. And I think that when you look at Putin and his all his bare-chested bear wrestling and all that kind of thing, there was I think that it was his birthday just before Christmas, and we were told that he'd taken part in an ice hockey match and scored 12 goals or something. That's very Neronian. That's so I would say that Putin is a kind of cross between Augustus and Nero.
Tom Holland, we're going to leave it right there for today, but you've left us with a lot to think about. Yes, in Moscow, but also closer to home, and we're grateful for that. The new book is Dynasty, The Rise and Fall of the House of Caesar. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Tom Holland, in London, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, this Friday, we will be taping a special On Point live show with member station KCLU in Santa Barbara, looking at the Latino plurality now in California and the rising Latino presence nationally. We'll air the show on Monday. We'd love your comments and questions now to take to the Santa Barbara stage. What do you think of the growing Latino population means for this country in terms of culture, economy, our politics, and how the U.S. evolves in this century? Let us hear from you at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Your input will inform our California conversations, and we really welcome it. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Caroline Bechtel and Maeve Pages. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.